The Manilow Method Podcast is a production by Logan Allen and me, Barry Harris. And now, let's start the show.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Manilow Method for our first real episode. We did an introduction episode, go back, watch that, get to know us. My name's Logan Allen, that's my co-host Barry Harris, and we're here to discuss Barry Manilow's discography, and we've chosen a great album to start our series off on. We are doing Even Now, released February of 1978, recorded in Hollywood, California, released on Arista Records. Now, Barry, you were born in the 90s. I was born in the 2000s, so we were not around for when this album came out, but please tell me, do you have any specific memories related to this album?
Well, it was an album that just was. I don't have a physical memory of when it first came into my life because it was already there, but my father in particular, he does have memories of when this first came into the world. He was a young, he was just about 14 years old when this album came out. He had gotten into the music of Barry Manilow after the live album came out. He had heard the live album. A friend was playing it for him. And it dawned on him that there was this man that was responsible for all the music that he was hearing on the radio that he really liked. So he didn't know who Barry Manilow was. He just knew some of the songs. But it was the live album that made it all come together for him. And so Even Now was the first album that he ever got to experience it on its street date. And so that was a very profound experience for him. But I grew up on this music. It was such a constant in my life. And, you know, this is a quintessential Barry Manilow record.
I mean, this album alone had four hit singles on it. Copacabana, Somewhere in the Night, Can't Smile Without You, and Even Now. Like, that is insane for an album of that time to have so many hits off the same track list. And as we've said, I wasn't alive for this either, so growing up with things in the 2000s, greatest hits compilations were flowing, and obviously those four songs were on every single greatest hits album that came out. So even though I didn't necessarily grow up with this particular album, I grew up with the hit songs from this album, and I'm sure a bunch of our viewers can relate. These are the songs that really define this era of Barry Manilow. So let's talk about here. Let's talk about how it was released, because I don't have a huge collection per se of physical Manilow media, but this is an album that I do have some things. So Barry, take us through the release forms for this album, and I'll hold up the things that I actually have.
Yes. So obviously, when Even Now came out on the street, it was released in a vinyl format. And Logan, you've got that right there.
Oh, I'm so prepped. I've got another one on my wall. Hang on.
Whatever. Oh, really?
Side it's on. I've got one on my wall, so yeah, whatever. These are, I have duplicates of all these, so I can hold them up. But here it is, the Even Now album. That's him looking over the New York City skyline right there. Yeah, and then the back is also the skyline as well. Very nice. I feel so accomplished being able to hold that up.
Well, I think a lot of people had multiple copies of
Yes.
Even Now, and there were some other formats they released it in at the time. So check this out. Have you ever seen one of these, Logan?
What is that?
It's a reel-to-reel. It's a four-track reel-to-reel.
Interesting. I revealed my age by asking what that was.
So right here you can see it's an actual reel. You put it on, and then you have a collector reel that takes the other end of it, and then you put it on the machine. And this was invented as a way they were trying to find a very portable format that could maybe be played in the car. The reel-to-reel didn't like really take off, so they decided then to create what's called 8-tracks, and this is what I have here.
Yes.
Let me show that for those who can see. This is a cassette cartridge that you would stick into the player, and again, this was their attempt to try to bring pre-recorded music into the car. And so by the 70s, this was a very common format. Almost every car had an 8-track stereo inside, so this is the way you would get to listen to music on the go. And then they also started to make, in the late 70s, compact cassettes, which I have here. Do you have one, Logan? I think
right
yours.
There. Ooh, we have different colors.
Well, there's a reason for that. This is interesting. This is actually a remastered version. When they they remastered Even Now in 1996.
And so let's hold both of ours up right here just so we can both get... There it is. Very nice.
And on the back here, it actually has the remaster bonus track from 1996, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And then, obviously, because Even Now came out in 1978, they came out on compact disc. And I have all three of the issues. This is the original issue of compact disc from the 1980s. It came out in all the territories, including North America. And then in 1996, this is the aforementioned 1996 remaster. They called it the Barry Manilow Masters. And on the back, they have a current photograph of Manilow along with some commentary from Manilow on the album. And then last but not least, in terms of releases that we're showing, this is now the most current version. This is a remaster they put out in 2006. And instead of one bonus track, it now has two bonus tracks and complete liner notes, and they have a nicely restored back cover here that mirrors exactly what was on the original LP release. So this album, this is a testament to how popular this album was. Like I said, this is the quintessential Barry Manilow album. What I think about this album is that this is what launched Barry Manilow into the stratosphere, into legendary status. Because if you take everything that came before Even Now, that would be a very notable career. But this was the one that just cemented that legend. And I think for many of the people that I know who are watching our program today, they grew up on this album. And this album in particular really has a lot of meaning for them. So it's really an honor to get to talk about this. And I know a lot of our listeners and our viewers here are just really eager to relive some great golden memories as we talk through these songs.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, talking through the songs, this was very popular for the albums of the time. They would release these song books that had all of the songs on the album in basic format. Piano, vocal, guitar, chords. This is one of the few that I own, but there's a lot more that I still need to find. But yeah, they would release these, again, just for the fans that loved the music. People like Barry and I, if we were alive in 1978. So before we get into the actual tracks, let's talk about the people who played on this album. Okay, I've got my cheat sheet here. I'm going to try to pronounce all these names correctly. Nobody sue me if I get one or two wrong, but here we go. So Manilow himself obviously does lead vocals. He does the acoustic piano. He actually did background vocals on every single track except Copacabana. And talk about this. We're going to talk about the string arp on one of the tracks. We'll talk about what that is once we get to that track. But then Bill Mays played the keyboard. Paul Schaefer played the electric piano on Somewhere in the Night. Barry, who is Paul Schaefer?
Well, Paul Schaefer was the leader of David Letterman's house band for David Letterman's entire run on both NBC and CBS. When David Letterman was on NBC, they called themselves the world's most dangerous band. And then they went to CBS, where they became the CBS Orchestra. And interestingly, there's another connection to another person you're going to mention, but I'll let you continue and I'll tell you who that is when you get to them.
Absolutely. Next up, Mitch Holder played the guitar, and then there's a lot of guitar players on this album. The guitar players were Mitch Holder, Jeff Miranov,
It's actually Lee Ritenour, and he's very notable. He's very notable because right after this album, he became very notable as a solo artist, an acclaimed solo artist. I've actually seen him perform, and he is just amazing.
So on guitar was Mitch, Jeff, Lee, and Jay Graydon. They all played guitar. And now here is a big name from the Manilow catalog that will be brought up on all sorts of other episodes. On the bass is Will Lee.
Yes. Will Lee. So Will Lee was in the aforementioned Most Dangerous Band, or the CBS Orchestra, along with Paul Schaefer. Will Lee played bass the entire run when David Letterman was on regular broadcast television. And Will Lee has played on more Manilow records than almost anybody. I think Rod Dante might be the most common, Alan Estes as well. But Will Lee has played on so many of Barry Manilow's hit records, from Barry Manilow 2, This One's For You, Even Now, One Voice. He has been a staple. And most recently was back working with Manilow again on the This Is My Town album that just came out within the last decade. So Will Lee and Barry Manilow have had a long time association. We're going to be talking about him a lot on our program.
So something to talk about here, there's a handful of people that only played on one track. Paul Schaefer played the electric piano. Bob Babbitt played the bass on one track. Jimmy
Wow.
Young played the drums on one track. And Jimmy Malin, correct?
Yes.
Again, yes. Jimmy Malin played percussion on one track. And it's interesting to bring up why it's only one track. We will talk about that when we get to that track. So, Ronnie Zito played the drums on every other track that Jimmy Young did not play the drums on. And then, as you mentioned, Alan Estes played percussion on this album. So we're seeing a lot of people who were mainstays around this time in the Manilow universe, which, honestly, that might have something to do with the hits of this. Back in the day, he'd have all these people playing on these hits, and he kept bringing the same people back. It was like he wasn't repeating the song formula, but he was almost repeating the production formula. And I think that's what worked for him around this time. So now we have some special background vocalists to mention. I think I can read my handwriting. Ginger Blake, Laura Creamer, and Linda Dillard all did the female background vocals on Copacabana. And a big whopper here at the end, Ron Dante did background vocals on every track except for Copacabana. Ron Dante is a huge name. We're probably going to do some sort of special separate episode just on the work of Ron Dante. So we won't go too far into him right now. So those are the people that played on the album. As we go along, I'm going to mention who orchestrated each song. Let's do this. Let's get into the first track list discussion of the Manilow Method, shall we?
Here we go.
You ready, Barry?
Yes,
all right,
I'm
here
ready.
We go. Track number one, it's a doozy, folks. Copacabana at the Copa, written by Barry Manilow, Bruce Sussman, and Jack Feldman. Obviously, there's not a ton that needs to be said for Copacabana, but Barry, give me some of your thoughts.
Well, Copacabana, well, it's so interestingly here on our program for the very first track we talk about, it's literally one of the most iconic Barry Manilow tracks ever. And so there is a lot to talk about. It's, you know, when Barry Manilow was doing a VH1 special when he was promoting his Summer of 78 release, he happened to comment that those chords, he's like, who would have thought those would be my most famous chords ever? When you hear those chords, you know it's Copacabana. And I know this because I've played many piano bars, and as soon as I start playing those chords, everybody instantly recognizes what song is going to play. And that, along with the very, very distinct rhythm of the drums and the cowbell, that is something that creates a signature that is immediately identifiable. And in so many Barry Manilow songs, it's really a hallmark of his that he knows how to put elements into these tracks and into these songs that are part of the DNA that make them so recognizable that you, as soon as they come on the radio, you know it's Barry Manilow.
Exactly. So right here in my hand, I have this interesting booklet. This is from the box set that they released in the 90s. And there's a few write-ups on Copacabana in here. I want to make mention of one thing here in particular. Jack Feldman, one of the lyricists on this album, he mentions in these notes, I'm going to quote him directly here. It says, "When we wrote Copacabana, I had never written a pop song before." He was involved with musical theater, so this was can you imagine the first pop song that you helped write turned out to be the one thing that gave Barry Manilow a Grammy in his career?
I can't believe that. What a coincidence that he's the first effort right out of the gate, and already there's a Grammy.
Yeah, it's something else to mention here. Bruce Sussman mentions it in these notes, that they thought they were writing a sort of novelty cut for this album, that they thought, you know, it's going to go on the album, people will listen to it once or twice, that'll be that. But it just blew up, and it took them all by surprise. And something interesting to talk about is the long version of Copacabana with the really drawn-out middle section. Give me your thoughts on that.
So this is a great story that my father passed down to me. So he went out, like I mentioned at the top of this episode, that he went out and bought it when it hit the street, and he loved this album so much, he played it so often that he wore it out. And so therefore, he had no choice but to go back to the record store and buy another copy of Even Now. Maybe that's what contributed to its big sales. People might have been wearing out their copy that they needed to go and buy another. So
when I know he, I would have.
Right. So he drops the needle onto the turntable, and as soon as Copacabana starts to play, he's shocked because Copacabana was different. So here's what really happened. Copacabana comes out on the album, and because of its popularity, they decided to remix it into a disco version with a longer extended bridge. And for all subsequent pressings of Even Now, they went in and replaced the original version of Copacabana with a longer disco version. And my father discovered this because of his situation. And so it really goes to show that they did not know that Copacabana was going to explode. And interestingly, the origin of Copacabana goes back to a time when Barry and Bruce happened to be on a vacation, just taking a break from their work, and they were by Copacabana Beach, and they asked each other, has there ever been a song about this? And so the idea was planted in their mind of maybe they should write a song about Copacabana. So they had the idea for a long time, and it took about a lot of time elapsed when Barry, Bruce, and Jack got to work on actually writing the song. And Bruce and Jack gave the lyrics to Manilow, and they apparently read it to him rhythmically. They said they read it to him as, her name was Lola, she was a showgirl, And Manilow said, you'd have to be dumb to not know how to write a melody to that when they're giving you such gold. And so that was how they conceived the song Copacabana. And like you said, it was supposed to be a novelty cut, but the story goes that Barry and Ron Dante, his co-producer, they decided to take a finished version of the song, and they went to a nightclub, and as he says, he bribed the DJ, asked him to put that record on, and they saw, and they hid in the shadows and watched all these people rush onto the dance floor. And wow. So Manilow and Ron are thinking, wow, we've kind of struck gold here. And they actually went to Clive Davis, the president of Arista Records. And Clive Davis didn't really think it was going to be a success. And it only became a success because the album came out and people just kept requesting it and kept requesting it at their radio stations, that eventually they relented and they put out Copacabana as a single that then actually that went up the charts and, you know, and then actually achieved ubiquity in 1978. What an amazing, you know, it's an amazing arc for something that started off as just a novelty cut, became pretty much one of the most identified songs. When you say Barry Manilow, Copacabana is probably one of the first things you think of.
So I think something that's important to bring up with this song is the fact that at this point in his career, I think this might be one of the most complex orchestrations when it comes to the actual orchestra playing, but then also the different layers that are happening. Every time you reach a different percussion break, I'm talking about the long version of the song specifically. Every time you reach a percussion break, there's all these different things happening. Tambourines, shakers, bongos, different bells, the drum kits grooving. And I think that's part of what makes the song so satisfying to listen to is, yeah, the melody's great, the progression's great, the string section is great, but all these percussion layers just kind of hypnotize you. And I think that really is what helped sell the song, is just that relentless groove through the whole thing. And something that I found was interesting in the long version, there's a percussion break a little more than 3 minutes in, and then as we're coming back towards the last verse of the song, everybody knows this as the main chord progression. Everybody recognizes that as the main part. But here, coming into the third verse, he flip-flopped the order of those chords. So instead of starting here and walking down, he starts here and he walks up. So that section sounds like this. but then it keeps going up here, back down, then back down, and then back up to where everybody knows it. So I'd be interested to hear. There's going to be a lot of speculation, a lot of conspiracy theories on this show. Sorry, not sorry. It's just what you're going to get from the two of us. Barry, what is a theory, do you think, just off the top of your head, why he may have done this? Because we know that everything on Mandela's records have a purpose. What do you think the purpose was in his mind orchestrating this song and just flip-flopping the chord progression for just this one moment? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, like you said, the work that Dr. Manilow does on all of his records are very intentional, and I think that he always has an idea in his mind whenever he's doing an arrangement on what the emotion is supposed to be. And of course, at this moment, the character that we're singing about in the song has been dealt a devastating blow, and mm-hmm. so there might be a different kind of emotional effect if you reverse the chord progression and just show that's where we are leading into the third and final verse.
Yeah, I like that idea. It's giving the sense that, yes, it's the same song, but the story is changing, so something's going to slightly change in the arrangement. So that's really all I wanted to cover on this song. Is there anything else that you have? This episode's going to be terribly long, but is there anything else that you have to cover on Copacabana before we move on to track two?
Yeah, just a few comments about some of the instrumentation, because you've already talked a lot about the percussion. The musical layers are just amazing. Will Lee's bass line is so great on this song. One thing that you don't hear on the original version of Copacabana that you really do hear on the disco version is that you hear the electric piano by Bill Mays, and he's really grooving on the keys, and especially at the end in the fade out, he's really going to town. It's a great moment, great solo moment. And on the original version, you hear Manilow's acoustic piano, whereas on the disco version, they take that out of the mix. So you really don't hear piano on the disco version. So I just thought that was my final note on this, to show how they evolved the two mixes. The original mix, very reverberated. Then the new disco mix was less reverberated and a little bit more crisp. And like I said, they turned down the acoustic piano, and they turned up the electric piano, but it's a great, both versions are great, but of course that disco version with that amazing bridge, that amazing bridge with that amazing arc, that is a real amazing Manilow moment. And so this is a great iconic track, and I think it's clear why. And of course we love it so much. And last thing I'll say about Copacabana is, people usually ask me, why do I listen to music over and over that I've heard before? And the answer is because I literally hear something every time I listen closely that I did not hear before.
Exactly.
We will continue to listen to this song, and we'll get more insights, and maybe we'll come back and have more to say about Copacabana perhaps in the future.
Exactly. So now that we are, 2 hours into this, let's move on to track number two. And this is the one I was alluding to earlier, where the entire rhythm section is different than the rest of the album. So track two is the hit song Somewhere in the Night. The rest of the album, as I mentioned, was recorded in California. This song was recorded in New York City. So that is why you're going to see in the liner notes that the main rhythm section, the bass player, the drummer, the percussionist, the guitarist, they were all different on this particular song, because it was recorded on the exact opposite end of the country from the rest of the album. So the first thing I want to mention here is, yes, this is a hit. A lot of people know this song, but I revisited this original version multiple times listening in preparation for this episode. And every single time when it was over, I just kept thinking, this song is at the top of the list when we try to epitomize the music of Barry Manilow. This has everything. It's got the key change. It's got the orchestra. It starts small with just the piano, and then it ends on this huge flourish. It really has everything that musicians like us and any musicians that are watching might think of when we think Barry Manilow. So, Barry, what are your thoughts on Somewhere in the Night?
I think you said it very well, Logan, that this really is a great example. If we were just to pick one song that encapsulates everything that Barry Manilow would do on a pop record, especially for the 1970s, this would be it. It has everything. I think this may be one of his strongest vocal performances from the 1970s. You've got great instrumentation on this. Bob Babbitt, who you mentioned, who played bass, that guy is a Motown legend. He played on songs like Side Seal, Delivered, and so many other songs. So it's no surprise that he's got somebody really great on, you know, on the instrumentation, and Paul Schaefer, as you mentioned. But Somewhere in the Night, it's such a well-written song by Richard Kerr and Will Jennings. This songwriting team brought many of Manilow's hits to him, including Looks Like We Made It. So it made sense to have them come back and contribute another song to Manilow's next album. And one thing that we're going to do throughout this series is talk about Clive Davis's involvement in the records. And one thing that is well known that Clive Davis has talked about, he talked about it in his memoir that I had read, that he had a contract with Barry. And the contract said, had a clause, that Clive could place up to two songs that Manilow had to record. So one thing that's fun for us to do is to listen to these albums and try to guess which songs were the Clive Davis songs. And I think Somewhere in the Night is the Clive Davis song number one.
I think that is a strong guess to make, because when you think about the fact that it was recorded in a separate studio, it's almost like they decided to do this song either before the other ones were done or after the other ones were done. So it's interesting that maybe since Clive might have picked this song, maybe that's why you see the change in studio and it's on the other side of the country, is because it was a part of a different conversation than songs like Copacabana and Even Now. So one thing I want to mention, you mentioned this is one of the best vocal performances maybe from the 70s. He holds this high G at the end, which I don't remember the last time I heard him hold that note, if I've heard him hold it in a concert. You could not say that five times fast. But yeah, I thought that was very interesting that this is a big song with two writers that are not Manilow. So I think you're onto something saying this could be the Clive Davis pick.
You know, another thing that I have to say about this song, it has one of the greatest single lines, maybe an Eddie song, music to magic to end. And when that lyric happens, as I was listening to this in headphones, I listened closely, and then I realized a moment that my ear was always drawn to. I realized there is a second piano track, a second lead piano track that is overdub. So when they hit the key change, "You're my song, music to magic to end," and there's this overdub piano that just goes, "I'll play you over." That's actually one of my most favorite moments on this track. And so it's the little subtleties that Manilow puts into his albums is kind of what makes people like Logan and I come back for more and more and more.
Absolutely. And it's what makes his concerts so compelling. Because nowadays, he plays the hits. He's got to play the hits. This is a song that finds a regular spot in the set list live, and it's a great example of how he can stay true to the original concept of the song, but kind of blow it up. Sounds like a bad term because it sounds like he's exploding it, but kind of blow it up to a more modern sound and make it translate well in an arena in 2025 when it was a hit song in 1978. And I think that's something that's very noticeable in his discography and in his style of writing and arranging, is the fact that these songs were huge almost 50 years ago, but he can go out and do a show in an arena and bring the audience to tears and get them on their feet at the end of every song, just because these songs hold up so well all these years later. So now, without further ado, let's dive into track number three. The first deep cut, I would say, from this album. It's called A Linda Song, and if I am not mistaken, this is the only lyric on this album written by Enoch Anderson. Barry Manilow and Enoch Anderson wrote this song. This is a beauty. I love this song so much. And I want to bring this up. I don't remember where I read this, but around this time, Manilow has said that by this point in his career, they had perfected the art of making pop songs. They had perfected the art of the production, of the writing, of everything about it. They had perfected it at this point. And like I said, Somewhere in the Night is the hit example of this. I almost think this is one of the deep cut versions of everything Manilow has to offer. While there's no key change, there's still the string sections. There's the flow and dynamics between the sections in the song, because the verses are very just calm, him singing with the piano with some light instrumentation under it. But then as it builds along, you have all of these hits with the full band, which that chord progression, A minor, G minor, F, I love that. But that is something to me that really makes this song stand out on this album with so many other standout tracks. And one thing I want to mention, there is only one account that I have seen of this song ever being performed live. Barry, do you want to explain when this song was performed live that we know what happened?
Yes, so we've gotten some accounts from fans who were there, who were present at the time, and they wrote about their memories for the Barry Net, that during his 1997 tour called the Reminiscing Tour, also known as the Clicker Tour, it involved Manilow spinning a wheel or getting an audience member to spin the wheel and stop the wheel, and whatever album would be on the wheel when the wheel stopped would be the album he drew songs from and would perform them. He'd reminisce, talk about the album, and then do a couple songs from the album. And during that segment, he usually would ask the audience member that he was talking to and was going to interact with if there was any particular song they wanted to hear, and they asked for a Linda song, and he was taken aback by that. As he said, well, the band doesn't know it, but let me take it during intermission, let me see if I can sort it out. And he came back from intermission, and he played it live for maybe the only time ever.
So if you're someone out there who saw him in the 70s or on that Clicker tour, and you know of a time that he played this song live and you saw it, or you know somebody who saw it, please reach out to us, because I am so interested to see, because I love this song. I am so interested to see. I'm getting excited. I'm stumbling over my words. I'm so interested to see if he ever played this song. So please reach out to us, themanilowmethod@gmail.com. Please. Like, that would be insane if this was the only time he played it live, or if he did it maybe on the Even Now tour back in the day just a couple times. So that's pretty much all I wanted to talk about with this. Do you have anything else you'd like to share?
Yeah, the thing that I noticed about this song, it's the only one that I believe on the album that doesn't have, well, it's one of the very few that doesn't have a backing vocal arrangement or harmonies. You know, this one, so that stands out, that this is different from the rest of the track. So it's different in a really good way.
So I want to mention, because I'm on a roll of forgetting things on this episode already, Somewhere in the Night was orchestrated by Dick Burke, and then this song was orchestrated by Richard Wenzeller. I think I got that pronunciation right, Richard Wenzeller. So those were the arrangements on the last two songs. Are we good to move on?
Yes.
Are we good to push forward? All right, here we go. Another doozy of a track, Can't Smile Without You. Pretty much every fan alone knows this song. It was written by Chris Arnold, David Martin, and Jeff Morrow. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, this song definitely has the most key changes on this record. And nowadays, he does it live. He drops it a half step so it doesn't end up in the stratosphere. I have a question, Barry, since you're so knowledgeable about so many different eras of the live performances. When can you, right now on the spot, estimate, when do you think the last time was that he performed this song with the whistling intro?
Wow, I believe it was during Live at the Gershwin on Broadway, to my knowledge. Or actually, I think during the whenever he did the Can't Smile duet segment, he would usually start the whistle off. So I think perhaps,
because I think I remember it So Manilow TV, for those of you who don't know, is the online subscription service where you can pay, I think it's $10 a month to watch X amount of different Barry Manilow concerts every month. Barry and I are both subscribed. If you're a fan of Barry Manilow, we both recommend it. I've seen some shows, for some reason off the top of my head, maybe from the Greatest Hits Tour in 94. Maybe him doing it there, for some reason, that's ringing a bell with me.
I believe he did it on the Two Nights Live album. He began with The Whistle.
So, yeah, that would be interesting. If somebody out there wants to go do some research for us and reach out and tell us, when is the last time he did The Whistle? Because I've seen him a handful of times live, starting from 2012 up till now. And I've never seen him do The Whistle. The band always just goes straight into it. So I would be interested to know, when is the last time he did The Whistle?
Well, funny enough, he struggled with it when he was live at the Greek, if you remember.
Yep.
On the video, he said, I'm having some trouble whistling. I need you all to do it. But he said, I swear I did it on the record. But he claimed it took him like 30-something takes to get that final record that you hear.
So, yeah, just something I wanted to mention was the fact that this record version is the definition of easy listening music. Nowadays, when he does it live, it's very upbeat and the drums are all in and everything. On the record, it feels like, you know, sitting around the campfire, swaying with everybody, singing the song. But live nowadays, it's much more of just this upbeat, chipper, almost kind of a show tune. With every key change that happens, a musical theater just screams at me. So give me your thoughts on the orchestration on this song, which was by Artie Butler once again.
Yeah, I mean, the orchestration is so beautiful. I think a challenge with singing a song like this for anybody else is that you're taking a title and you're repeating it 10 different times, and there's not a lot of variety to the lyrics. So the real meat of this has to be in the music, and I think that's why it's so elaborate. But the one thing I wanted to point out about Can't Smile Without You is I think it's in the same vein as Looks Like We Made It, how people cite it as the ultimate love song, and it's used to celebrate people's marriages, their weddings, when if you really read into these lyrics, it is not a happy song, because the last new line you hear, well, I'm finding it hard leaving your love behind me. So this is not a happy song at all. And I think maybe the musicality might make you think it's happy, but it's not a happy song.
Yeah, I think that's something, like you said, Looks Like We Made It's another good example. And as we go through this show, I'd be interested to make a list of songs that fit in this vein that sound upbeat and chipper, but they're really depressing. I think that speaks to Manilow's ability to arrange and craft a song in a way that is unique to him by taking what could be a sad lyric and putting a beautiful instrumentation with it, so you're distracted by the vibe of the song and you're not really listening to what he's actually saying. So I think that's very interesting to bring up, that this and Looks Like We Made It can kind of fall into the same category. Is that all you have for this song?
And the other thing I wanted to mention is that this is what I think to be the second Clive Davis pick. And I can tell you why I am very certain of that. There's an artist by the name of Gino Cunico who was signed to Arista Records in 1976. But to my knowledge, he was the first Clive Davis artist to record this song. Clive Davis had him do Can't Smile Without You. And one of Clive Davis's methods that I know of is that if he really believes in a song, if he gives it to one artist and they don't hit with it, he will give it to another artist and hope that they will have a hit with it. Now, Gino Cunico, keep that name in mind, because that artist is going to come up later on in a future episode, because Gino Cunico was a singer-songwriter, and one of his original songs on that 1976 album was called When I Wanted You, which Manilow himself would later cover in the next album. So Gino Cunico was the first Clive Davis artist that I know of who did this, so this is definitely a Clive Davis pick.
Okay, so I think we will have solid guesses that Somewhere in the Night and Can't Smile Without You were the Clive Davis songs on this album. So that's very interesting. Now, let's move on. I know this next song is one of your favorites on this album, and it's really grown on me as well. This is a song called Leaving in the Morning. It was written by Barry Manilow and lyrics by Marty Panzer. Marty Panzer is a huge name in the Manilow lore, I guess you could call it. Something I wanted to mention from this And this kind of harkens back to something I said about Copacabana. The percussion makes this song for me. Just the ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch, all that stuff that's rocking in the back of this song. It's the things that aren't at the forefront but are still present that I think really provide the glue to hold this song together. What do you like about this song, Barry?
Well, what I like about this song is, I think it's actually notable on this album, it's one of the very few to not have a horn or a string section on it. It has a string ARP, it's a synthesizer, that's actually played by Barry Manilow on this particular record. So this is a little bit of a contrast to everything else that's on this album. But it's just a really well arranged and sung pop song. It's full of tension and drama in the way that the harmonic chords that are chosen really feel like they are matching the mood of the lyrics, and you've got a really great vocal arrangement. So that's why this one in particular has always been a personal favorite of mine. I may have spoiled the end of our program, because in the program we're always going to, Logan and I are going to pick three songs. I might have given one of them away already.
I think it was pretty obvious if you said it or not. Just one thing I wanted to say before this. I can't think of many other songs in the discography off the top of my head that sound quite like this one. And it might have something to do with the fact that there is no orchestration. But I can't think of many other songs that have, like you said, that tension in it, that are the same vibe as this. I'm struggling to think of something else like that. So again, if you're watching this, you're going to hear us say this a million times. If you're watching this and you can think of another song that's like this, please let us know, because we're going to try to cover everything on this show. But next up, track 6 is another deep cut track, but it's a beauty. It's a real beauty. Track 6, Where Do I Go From Here, written by Parker McGee. Now, something that our viewers are going to get very used to with us if they keep returning to our show is that we reference one specific Manilow album a lot in our regular conversations, and as we're going to go through this show. We both love the album Here at the Mayflower. I thought this song kind of gave me similar vibes to the Mayflower cut She Should Have Been Mine. I feel like it could fit in the same vein, like back in the 2000s, Mayflower came out. He was doing She Should Have Been Mine live. I think a similar section could have done this song well. And something else I wanted to mention, it also seems like it's one of the simpler songs so far on this album. As we've gone through the songs we already have, it feels like one of the simpler songs. So, Barry, give me your thoughts on this one.
So, one thing I can tell you about this song, I think this may be one of the most beloved fan tracks ever. And I know this because when in the Westgate, this is the Westgate Hotel, a casino in Las Vegas, where Barry Manilow is currently in residence as their artist. He has his The Hits Come Home show that's running and has been running for a long time. They had a display piano in their lobby area, and anybody was allowed to go up and play it. So, of course, when I went to go see Manilow, as soon as the curtain closed, I would run for the piano and then run over and start playing Daybreak and Copacabana, and I would draw a crowd. And then the people that would linger on were the fans, and they started to ask me for the songs that they wanted to hear. And Where Do I Go From Here came up a lot, so I had to sing this one a lot, which I was totally ready for, because I love it too. It's such a beautiful song. I believe it's one of my mom's favorite songs. I have a friend of mine, Chris, from California. She's a great longtime Manilow fan. I know she's told me many times that this is one of her favorite songs, so this really has a place in many people's hearts. And I guess it begs the question, if this had been maybe pushed as a single, would this have hit the top 40, top 20, top 10? Who knows? Maybe I think it could have.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head any time that this song ever got played live.
No.
So again, reach out to us. I've given that spiel too many times already. But I thought this was interesting. Again, I don't know if this was on purpose or not, considering Manilow's not a writer on this song. But the lyric, I wish my mind could let you go, Two tracks later, we get the song "I Was a Fool to Let You Go." So I don't know if track placement was leading up to that. I don't know. Again, speculation galore on this show. But yeah, this song caught me off guard because, like you said, it does sound like it could have gotten some traction had they focused on it. Obviously, I think the hits deserve to be hits, but this one's kind of a wild card for me. I can see this one being beloved, like you just said. So with that, we have finished side one. Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time for the day. If you haven't recognized at this point, Barry and I love to talk about this music, so there are still a lot of songs that we have yet to talk about on this album. That's going to be coming this coming Wednesday. It's going to be from the same conversation. We still have the same train of thought. We just chopped it in the middle so you don't have to watch hours of footage in one sitting. So real quick before we go, I want to make a brief plug for the Manilow Music Project. That is Dr. Barry Manilow's nonprofit organization that donates funds, equipment, instruments, you name it, to schools in need with music programs in need. You can donate and learn more about them over at ManiloMusicProject.org and on social media at Manilow Music Project. They're a great project with a great mission. We highly recommend you check out the work that they do. Right now, our theme music that we're using on the Manilow Method is based on Frédéric Chopin's Prelude in C minor. It's performed by my co-host, Barry Harris, and for those of you Fanilows out there in the audience, you'll know that Dr. Manilow's song, Could It Be Magic, is based off that same Prelude in C minor. So before we go, we just want to say thank you to Barry Manilow and his band and his crew and everyone that has helped him achieve success along the way, and we hope that you will tune into part two of our album discussion here in a couple of days. We'll see you soon, everybody.